Good morning, everyone. The staff has won, so we're in a position to begin. I'd welcome. This is Education and Finance Division. I'd like to call us to order. Representative Pryor, have you had an opportunity to review the Wednesday, January 30th minutes?
I have, Mr. Chair, and I move that we adopt the minutes.
Thank you very much. Any discussion to the prior motion? Well, that's a funny statement. Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Thank you very much. Dr. Melcher, welcome back to the committee. We have three portions to the hearing today. You and your staff completing the slide deck and your presentation on special ed. Then we're going to hear from a panel of superintendents on the on-the-ground impact. And then we have Representative O'Neill up for her bill being heard related to special ed in the Monticello district and the unique situation there. So what slide did we leave off on yesterday, sir?
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Tom Melcher. I'm the Director of School Finance at the Department
Thank
of Education,
you.
And we were on slide 23.
Oh, we were. Thank you very much.
So, Mr. Chair and members, what slide 23 shows is the trend in special education costs and state and federal aid and the cross subsidy since 2003. And we briefly looked at that yesterday. I won't spend a lot of time on it, but just to recap, current expenditures are totally $2.48 billion. Federal aid is roughly $182 million, state aid about $1.6 billion, and the cross subsidy is currently at $724 million. And you can see that the projection by 2023 is for the cost to grow up to a little over $3 billion and the cross-subsidy to grow to about $858 million. Mr. Chair and members, the next slide is just providing a little more breakdown of the cross-subsidy. And what it's showing is the blue line at the top there is the total amount of the cross subsidy. The red line is what the cross subsidy would be if the federal government fully funded the 40% state share that was there in Kent when federal IDEA was passed. So it just gives you a sense of if the state fully covered the balance of the cross subsidy, we would be around $240 million currently. The difference there between the $236 million and the $724 million is the result of the federal government not covering that 40% target that they had set up at one time. If we look at the trend in the state and federal and overall shares of special ed funding, you can see that in recent years the state and federal government together have actually increased the portion of special ed costs that are covered. We're currently funding about 71% of the cost between the state and federal aid. State aid is about 63.5%, and the federal aid is about 7.3%. What you can see, though, is that the state share is growing and the federal share is declining. So we have had significant increases in state aid in recent years, but quite a bit of that is just simply to replace the reduction in the federal share. Not to say the federal dollars have gone down, but they've been flat, so they've been losing ground to inflation. And the state has actually increased its share from almost 60% to up to 63.5% just in the last few years. If we convert those numbers to the cross-subsidy per student, what you'll see is that currently the cross-subsidy per student on the average is $830 for every K-12 student in Minnesota. We project that with no change in state law, that will grow to $876 per student by 2023. These numbers are adjusted for inflation. So,
Dr. Melcher, pause for a moment. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Melcher, could you explain to me, I'm addressing this federal stagnation or not increasing and not keeping their promise. What kind of communication is done between people like you and the people like you in Washington about their responsibility and our responsibility?
Dr. Melcher?
I'd like to have Darren Corte respond to that.
Mr. Corte.
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, I think primarily we have communications with the congressional delegation more at the leadership level, at the commissioner level, certainly around this issue. I think our stakeholder organizations, such as the Minnesota Administrators for Special Education, the School Boards Association, AMSD, they traditionally make trips out to D.C. to meet with congressional delegation about this. In terms of discussions that we have with the U.S. Department of Education, you know, this is really out of their hands since it's an appropriations issue. It's not an implementation issue. So, yes, we do have communications with the congressional delegation about this, but it's a function of IDEA as a whole. The entire law has been long overdue for reauthorization, and it's just kind of in the queue waiting there to be addressed, and up till this point, they haven't taken it up.
And
Representative Murphy.
And Ms. Chair and Dr. Corte, then do they continue to take responsibility for the same percentage of delivery of services?
Mr. Corte?
Or do they say less?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, you know, I think that's something you'd have to take up with the members of our congressional delegation. I'm sure that there are some that would love to have this issue addressed and that are eager to do it, but one member can only do so much.
Oh, right.
You know.
And
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, and that's why I was asking, we're responsible for the following the Minnesota law and the federal law. And we keep having to put increased amounts of money. And we do go to the same people that you said suggest the politicians. There's not one of them that says that they don't want more money or that they realize that they're slipping. But somewhere between our congressional delegation and Wisconsin's congressional, all the other states' congressional delegations, and the people that are making out the projected budgets, which are different people than our congressional delegations, there's somebody that's saying, the states will make it up, the states will make it up. And how do we find out who those people are so we can say we don't have the amount of money that can make it up, and our people deserve that same kind of help, and they have the same responsibilities as the state does, and we can't keep stealing from some other pots of money to do it. And I want to know names. I want faces.
Phone numbers, email addresses.
People. Yeah, you know, let's get them. Let's explain our plight.
Mr. Corte, you want to try that?
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I was just offering that, you know, in terms of the budget development through the department, you know, we could put you in touch with folks that work on that and the undersecretaries that work on that.
I want us to do that. Us. Thank you. I won't carry on anymore, but I had to do it.
Thank you, Representative.
But I want you and me and Ms. Dr. Melcher, I want us to be carrying the message as well as, and maybe a few parents.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Murphy. You know, we kind of all laugh. We laughed at that, but it's not a laughing matter, really. This has been going on for years. And our legislative delegation, regardless of party, they are not doing their job to make sure that they're meeting the requirement, the mandate that they have set down for the states of 40%. So, and we can shrug our shoulders and laugh about it, but it's—I don't think it's a laughing matter. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chair, members, you can see here that the state average cross subsidy per student is $830. But if you go to the next slide, you'll see there's quite a bit of variation among school districts. This next slide shows the cross-subsidy per student in 2013, 2015, and 2017. These are adjusted for inflation. So what you can see is that in most of the areas of the state, the cross-subsidy has, in fact, increased on a per-pupil basis. The cross-subsidy is highest in the core cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul, and in the suburbs. Cross-subsidies are also quite high in the larger greater Minnesota cities. You can see the charter schools historically did not have a cross-subsidy because they could charge back the full cost of special ed to the resident district. Now you'll see the cross-subsidy is averaging about $106 per student in the charter schools because they have to cover 10% of the unfunded cost. Mr. Chairman, I thought it would be helpful to say a little bit about the mechanisms we use for funding special education, beginning with the old formula, which was in 2012 statutes. It was in effect through fiscal year 15. Under the old formula, the state funded 68% of salaries, 52% of contracted service costs, 47% of supplies and equipment. There was an excess cost aid based on 75% of the difference between the reimbursable expenditures and a percentage of the general education funding formula. Fringe benefit costs were not eligible for funding under the old formula. The old formula also had a cap in place. The cap came into effect in 1995. It limited the annual growth in funding. For a time, there was inflation on the cap. Between 2004 and 2007, there was no inflation provided for special ed. At that time, the cross-subsidy shot up quite a bit because special ed funding was essentially flat. The 2007 legislature installed the 4.6% annual inflation factor on special education, but the cost has grown at a higher rate. As a result of that, we had a statewide proration that was called the statewide adjustment factor. So in fiscal 15, the last year of the old formula, we were prorating the initial aid at 88%, and we were prorating the excess cost aid at 67%. So districts were getting 88% of that, 68% of salaries. It was a prorated funding level. In 2012, Commissioner Caselius convened an education finance working group that looked at a variety of issues, including special education funding. The working group made recommendations by a two-thirds vote in November of 2012. Their recommendations for special education on slide 31 included an increase of about $150 to $200 million in funding per year to help reduce the cross-subsidy. They also recommended replacing the old formula with a new formula that would eliminate the statewide cap in order to help reduce cross-subsidies. It would also include all special education costs not funded with federal aid. So the primary thing that was added there was the fringe benefit costs, the teacher's retirement, Social Security, and so forth. They recommended calculating aid using prior year data to improve predictability. They also recommended allocating a portion of the aid based on student data to try to align special ed funding a little bit closer with general ed funding, which is based on students. Most other states also have student-driven funding formulas for special education. And they also recommended requiring the serving district or charter school to cover a portion of the cost for open-enrolled students. So their recommendation was that the serving district or charter school would cover 10% of the unfunded cost. Governor Dayton in 2013 recommended the findings of the working group to the 2013 legislature. He included in his budget $126 million for fiscal 15, $158 million for fiscal 16, $167 million for fiscal 17. Neither the House nor the Senate accepted the governor's recommendations. However, in the conference committee, in the negotiations, I should say, between the governor and the leadership of the House and Senate, there was an agreement reached to add $40 million to the special education funding formula. So as a result of that, only a portion of the recommendations of the working group were adopted, and the changes that were made in order to live within the $40 million increase were first to create a temporary cross-subsidy reduction aid for 2014 and 2015, and then to do a scaled-down version of the governor's recommended formula. The 10% piece about the charter schools or non-resident serving districts picking up a portion of the cost was included also in that package. So the specific changes that were made to the governor's original recommendations as part of the kind of compromise package included, instead of calculating the initial aid based solely on student data, the funding formula uses the least of three calculations. One is the student-driven formula that the governor had recommended. The second is the old formula that was in effect before. And the third was a new formula that that included the cost of fringe benefits. The excess cost aid was also adjusted, so we look at calculating the aid both on the old formula calculation and the new formula calculation. And there was a hold harmless created to ensure that no district would get less money under the new formula than they received under the old formula. And there was also a growth cap put in. So the bottom line at the end of the day here, we got a lot of complicating changes to the funding formula, but there was a significant increase in the dollars, and school districts were guaranteed they would receive no less aid for fiscal 16 than they had received under the old funding formula. So, Mr. Chairman, I know that you're constrained for time here. I can go through the details of this formula, or I can move it along a little faster, depending on the committee's preference.
Any questions at this point? Because this might be where the education funding gets complicated. I'm not sure. Everybody's tracking. Let's keep going. Thank you, Dr. Melcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So slide 34 is going into detail on the new funding formula. We're covering 100% of the special transportation cost, plus 56%, it's the least of, 56% of the amount driven by a student-driven funding formula, or 62% of the old formula cost, which excludes fringe benefits, or 50% of the total non-federal cost, including fringe benefits. So for some school districts, some are on each of the three formulas. In fact, about a third of the districts are on each of the three formulas. It's in some cases, if a district had relatively low fringe benefit costs, they might do better with 62% of the cost excluding fringe benefits. Other districts that had high fringe benefit costs might do better with 50%. So we're calculating it each of those three ways, and in fact we're using the least of the three. Then we have the excess cost aid, which is the greater of 62% of the difference between the old formula cost, not reimbursed with initial aid, and 2.5% of the general education funding that the district is generating, or 56% of the total non-federal cost minus 7% of the general education. So, again, what we have here is a formula where it's a lower percentage of the full cost or a higher percentage of that narrow cost, and we're taking whichever one is better for the district. And what we find is in rural Minnesota, we tend to have more districts where the fringe benefit costs are relatively low, and so we have more rural districts that are on the old formula calculation here. And when it comes to the urban districts, they tend to be more on the new formula because the relative cost of the fringe benefits by the time you add up the retirement, the Social Security, the health insurance costs tend to be a little bit higher percentage of the salaries. And so we have some districts, again, about half of the districts on each of the two excess cost formulas.
Thank you, Dr. Melcher. Representative Sandell.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Melcher, thank you very much. The ratios that are listed here seem kind of subjective, at least to me. How were they established? Was it some sort of data-driven logarithm, I guess, or was it simply the funds available that established these ratios?
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, we started with the old formula, which had kind of similar mechanisms, and then we made adjustments in order to try to basically minimize the number of winners and losers as we shifted from the old formula to the new formula. So it was driven based on the dollars available and trying to cover basically a little bit more than we had been covering with the previous formula.
Yeah. Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Merritt.
Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the question I have for you, Mr. Melcher, is on that same vein. So right now we're in the situation where we're looking at the old formula and the money that was available in that budget year, and that's where we are right now, is all of these things put together, but none of it is saying, like, this is a new formula that we've developed yet. So we're using an old formula, a new formula, and how we're doing it is based on what money was available when we initiated the change. And is there a pathway to get out of where we are right now, where we can simplify this a little bit? Because otherwise, you know, we'll be here all if we really wanted to understand, I think we'd be here a long time.
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Pryor, it's a very, very good question. And so the reason for we're doing some calculations on the old and some on the new was the constraint that we had. So the committee, the working group we had recommended a change that would be roughly $150 million a year. Added cost, we had $40 million. So what we tried to do was move in the direction of the committee recommendations, but what could we do for $40 million versus $150 million? So we ended up somewhere in between, and we're kind of stuck there right now. It would take a fairly significant infusion of new dollars into the formula to simplify it significantly without creating winners and losers.
Representative Pryor? Thank you very much. Dr. Melcher, we've allotted about 10 more minutes for your presentation, if you want to hit the high notes.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me just say a little bit about tuition adjustments. Under the special education funding mechanism, school districts have students that open enroll to other districts, and the new formula is requiring the serving district to cover 10% of the unfunded cost. And currently, the special ed tuition adjustments are running about $207 million a year. So it's a sizable amount of money going back and forth based on tuition. I want to say a little about the hold harmless and the growth cap, because those are some of the more controversial things that were added into the funding formula. The hold harmless ensures that no district will receive less than it would have received under the old formula in 2016, adjusted later for inflation and enrollment change. The growth cap limited the increase that a district could receive to $80 per student in 2016, and then that's gradually increased. So this was the idea of kind of phasing out this cap by gradually increasing the increase factor. So currently, the hold harmless is about $6 million. We're bringing up districts that would otherwise get less by that amount, and the growth cap is holding down the aid by about $21 million. One of the issues that we run into with the growth cap and the hold harmless is that they're frozen based on 2016 data adjusted for inflation. The farther we've gotten away from 2016, the more we've learned that that becomes really problematic in special education, where the cost can vary so much from year to year. So as we get into kind of problems, issues, concerns, I think one of the fundamental problems we have with the special education funding formula right now is this kind of linkage to the 2016 data, and the fact that 2016 was a low year for some districts, it was a relatively unusually high year for other districts, and that kind of creates some inequities going forward. The inequities are greater for small districts because they tend to have more instability from year to year in the change in their special education costs. This slide is showing the portion of the district's costs that were covered by the different parts of the formula in 2017. So the initial and excess cost data, they're pretty uniform, covering about 60% of the cost. It's a little less for charter schools and co-ops. And the reason for that is our per-pupil-driven formula tends to hold the funding down for those because they have relatively high costs per pupil, so that becomes the least of the three. The tuition adjustments, you can see, makes up for that for the charters and the co-ops. And the districts that have the most negative impact from the tuition adjustment are the Minneapolis and St. Paul districts and the inner-ring suburbs, where it's taking away about 13% of their funding. hold harmless, and the growth cap are spread across districts throughout the state. And overall, we're covering about 60% of cost, but that's more like 50% in Minneapolis-St. Paul. And, of course, we're covering the full cost in the cooperatives and the charter schools. Or close to the full cost. As far as the use of the hold harmless, what you see here is that there are very few districts in the metropolitan area that are on the hold harmless, but there are quite a few, especially small rural districts. Again, that's because of that instability in the cost over time. And as far as the growth cap, what we see, again, is there's less in the metro area on the growth cap than there are in more of the rural districts. I'm sorry, I've got that reversed. There are more districts in the metro area that are on the growth cap than in the rural area of the state. So what are some of the issues or concerns? And I'll try to go through these very quickly, Mr. Chair. But the first issue that I hear about is that funding is not sufficient to stop the growth of the cross-subs and on slide 41. There simply are not sufficient dollars to keep the cross-subsidy from growing each year. A second concern that I hear is that the rates that we use in the pupil-driven part of the formula are out of date. They were based on the data we had available in 2012 when the bill was enacted. Each year the department does a study for the legislature that shows you what the current rates are. So we make that information available to the legislature annually to determine whether you want to adjust the pupil-driven part of the formula. But if you do that, it costs money. So that's been an issue. But just so you know, we're basing the pupil-driven part on data that's now 6 years old. When it comes to the hold harmless and the growth cap, I think the biggest issue with the hold harmless and the growth cap are that they're based on 2016 data, adjusted for an ADM change and inflation. And unfortunately, special education cost is not something that just grows by 4% a year. Some years it goes down, some years it goes up. It depends a lot on the nature of the students being served. And I think, you know, if I was going to do one thing to improve the special education funding formula, I'd be looking at how do we address the growth cap and the hold harmless to move away from this reliance on the 2016 data. The farther we get away from 2016, the worse it gets in terms of using that as a base for future calculations. With tuition billing, we hear that the resident district has little opportunity to control the cost of special ed services provided to its students who open and roll out of the district, and the tuition bills are often higher than what the district's unfunded cost would have been if it had served those students. So tuition billing is another area where we have significant challenges with the current formula. And the other thing that I hear, of course, is that the formula is very complex, and we need to do something to make it a little bit easier to follow and for districts to be able to predict and budget accurately. Mr. Chairman, I think I could go further, but I would, knowing that you have a little time, I'd like to see if there are questions.
All right. Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee members? Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Melcher, I'm just wondering if you can give just a quick history of the 40% that we always hear about coming from the federal government, or where it should be coming from the federal government, but it's not. Is that federal law? Where does that 40% come from?
Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Juergens, the 40% goes back to the 1970s when the federal special education law was put in place. And that was seen as a target by the federal government when they put the law in effect. There was, I don't believe, ever a guarantee that they were going to do it, but the idea was we're going to mandate these special education services, and we're committed to covering a portion of the cost. But I don't believe the federal government was ever really there. The department has done, I was just trying to pull out the numbers here, the department has done some analysis over the years as far as where we've been at. And, if we go back to the early 80s, we were only receiving about 12% from the federal government. We had some increases between 2000 and 2010 that brought us up to about 16-17%. For 1 year in 2010, The federal government doubled the amount of federal special ed aid. We got up to 30% that year. That was part of the recession recovery package that the federal government had. However, that only lasted 1 year, and then we went right back down to 14% the year after that. And what's happened since then is that the federal funding, and I'm talking about IDEA Part B, Section 611 here, the federal funding has been pretty stable around 180 to 190 million for the last 10 years or so. And unfortunately, with the cost of special education growing each year, that 180, 190 million is generating a smaller and smaller percentage each year. So now we're projecting that we're at about 10% as compared to the 40%.
Representative Juergens.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Hewitt, did you have a question?
More of a statement. I'm going to go into freshman status here because I decorum election certificate. Part of the reason I was sent here is because of the 24 million my district is in the hole. The 20 teaching positions we're going to lose, multiple other positions in the referendum that's going to be served on us next fall. Looking at the data, and thank you very much, gentlemen, for this data, it's time. It's time to go after the federal government. We have to start a lawsuit. It's hurting our state. It's so frustrating. I can't believe we're waiting this long. And this is multiple administrations, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm.
It's time. Minnesota has to lead. We have to do something. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. We've got one member with a question before we close. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Chair. You had referenced the 2016 data and the complications that provides. What are we going to do moving forward so that we have better data to actually go on so that we can actually meet the needs of our districts?
Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chair and Representative, what I would say is that we do a fairly good job of collecting data, and the data we have is much better than it was. I think the issue that we have is that we know that special education costs and the needs of students in districts vary from year to year to year. Mm-hmm. So the issue that we have is not that the 2016 data is bad, it just is not a good estimate of what districts might need in 2019 or 2020. So my suggestion is that we need to look a little closer at what are the current needs and not be so dependent on the data from 2016. So the simple solution would be to say we're no longer going to have a cap that's based on 2016 data, or if we can't afford to eliminate that, we could move to a cap that reflects what the current costs are and maybe guarantee that a district will, they won't get more than 65% or 70% of the current cost rather than some number based on 2016 data. The hold harmless is the same thing, where that's based on an old year. If we were going to bring newer data into play there, I think we could be more equitable across our school districts.
Representative Edelson?
Well, Chair Devney, I mean, I guess, thank you for that. How do we do that? I really am curious because the reality is I'm coming from Edina, and we're a wealthier school district, and we are also struggling in terms of special education. And so this is something that I think every single district in the state of Minnesota is struggling with right now in terms of budgetary concerns.
Thank you very much. With that, thank you, Dr. Melcher, Mr. Farron, Mr. Corte. Much appreciated. Next, we have a panel of superintendents representing urban, suburban, and rural districts to present on the impact of these complicated formulas on their districts and their students. So if those four superintendents would please come forward. If the pages can grab one more chair, please. And I think I saw some nodding heads out of this group as the previous discussion was going on. Welcome. I assume you have worked out the order of operations here. So if each of you would state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony. I'll let you figure out who's first and beyond. Dr. Gothard, welcome to the committee.
Great. Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. It's great to be here today. I'm Joe Gothard, Superintendent of St. Paul Public Schools.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. I'm Carlton Jenkins. That's C-A-R-L-T-O-N. Okay, from Robbinsdale Public Schools.
Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair and members. I am David Hansen. I am Superintendent at Buffalo Lake Hector and Stewart. We better make sure we get that in there. And I'm the rural district representative.
Thank you, Mr. Jenkins. Mr. Hansen, excuse me.
Mr. Chair, I'm Mike Funk, and I'm the superintendent of the Albert Lee Area School District.
Very good. Morning. Welcome to the committee, gentlemen.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'll start this morning giving you a little bit of context about St. Paul Public Schools and the great presentation that Dr. Melcher and his team just provided you. For some context for St. Paul Public Schools, we serve 5,682 students, 15% annually. St. Paul Public Schools serves over 7,500 students in special education, and this is really important, ages birth to 21. So this is far more than the K-12. In fact, the work we do post-18 and before kindergarten is quite impressive and something that is growing in our school district. We also have 13% of our students are identified as both English learners and special education, so twice exceptional in having some very specific needs and supports that we do provide. 68% of our students in special education also qualify for free and reduced price meals. Approximately 27% of our staff overall work with special education students. That's 700 licensed special education teachers and 500 paraprofessionals. And it's important to point this out because with some of the shortfalls that we have had by due to our budget, the supports in the classroom have become scarce, making the job that much harder. In fact, I could tell you right now that we have multiple openings across our nearly 70 school buildings to serve our students with special education who receive special education services. It is very challenging for our human resources departments, our schools, our special education leaders to attract and support and keep the very best people working with some of our most vulnerable populations in our schools. I'd also like to share with you that our greatest increase is in our early childhood special education. Our ECSE, or birth to age 5 services, has been growing approximately 10% each year. We've increased almost 200 students in the past 2 years in this time period of their lives. And again, we welcome the early childhood screeners. We know that if we can intervene in an appropriate way early, that child and his or her family are going to be that much more successful in our school district. Excuse me. The second greatest increase is autism spectrum disorders, or ASD. We're seeing also increase at a pretty high rate. So I'd also like you to know that we serve provide services in our school buildings and in more than 40 other sites throughout our city, throughout our community. And examples of those are our non-public school buildings, hospitals, day and residential treatment, and juvenile corrections. Our birth to five services are also provided at multiple sites, including Head Start, child care centers, home visits, early childhood pre-K sites, and within SPPS and outside agencies. We also have special education-only schools for students with severe cognitive disabilities or emotional behavioral needs. Bridgeview, Focus Beyond Journeys, and River East are just a few examples of the schools that we have that are truly specialized for those populations. So overall, our program and budget impact for the cross-subsidy, we've cut nearly $50 million over the last 4 years from our overall operating budget. In this current year that we live in right now, $17.2 million. The tuition billing from other districts have increased by approximately 14%, including $1.7 million in the past year. For the school year, fiscal year 17, MDE cross-subsidy was about $40 million, or $1,000 per pupil in St. Paul Public Schools. And it's projected to be about $1,400 per pupil, per student, for our fiscal year 18 in terms of that unreimbursed portion of our operating budget. So as you can see, our fiscal year cross-subsidy report is not finalized yet, but we are predicting, based on the trends that we've seen and some of the rises in services that we believe in providing, we'll see those numbers. So again, some of the impacts on that: inadequate resources for our interventions. We want to intervene appropriately and early. And those two things are really important. It's both of them. We want to do it right, and we want to do it early. And we need to have the very best staff to deliver those services. We're limited in our training for principals, teachers, paraprofessionals, in PBIS and social-emotional learning and trauma and intervention teams at each school. And it's important to add that special education is not a place in a school. It's not for certain staff. We live and believe in an inclusive school environment for our families, for our students, for all of our staff. It isn't a place. It isn't something that you get special education. It's part of the service delivery model of what we believe in public education. And in St. Paul Public Schools, we want to be sure that we're serving our students with the very best of our abilities, and we need resources to do this. The inadequate mental health supports, I think, crosses over into many different areas of what you're likely to hear and have heard already in previous testimony and in other days. And again, the reduction in paraprofessionals is really important to support our instruction in classrooms. Teachers can't do it alone. Paraprofessionals need support. And we need to build some consistency, some continuity of services is good for all as well. Lastly, some recommendations before I turn it over to my colleagues. We'd like an increase in regular access funding for special education to phase out the cross-subsidy. We know that this can't be done with the snap of a finger. It needs to be a long-term plan that gives us relief and allows us to, most importantly, to plan for the long term. We'd like to address tuition billing, especially when district doesn't place students, the discrepancy in rates by district, charter, and intermediate, the responsibility of resident versus serving districts. We'd like to see some help in that area. Provide incentives and flexibility to intervene before students qualify. Again, this gets back to that early and doing it right, having the best intentions to make sure that we're serving our students at the very start of their educational journey. Finally, we want to enhance medical assistance reimbursement for school social work services using the Wisconsin model where IEP drives those services. With that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I thank you, and I'll turn it over to, I believe, Dr. Jenkins.
Thank you, Superintendent. Dr. Jenkins, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, colleague, Dr. Gothard. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I bring you a different story from Robbinsdale Area Schools. A lot of the things that were stated by Dr. Gothard are very similar, not only in Robbinsdale, which happens to be a metro suburban district, but you can also feel this in the rural districts. As such, in the metro area and throughout, we came together, a group of superintendents, and said, let's look and see what can we do to transform the educational system in the state of Minnesota. So we came up with Reimagine Minnesota. Within Reimagine Minnesota, we came out of meeting with 3,000 people with a theme. And our theme was very simple, based on the feedback we received from the people. It said to see all, to serve all, and to support all. That brings us to this cross-subsidy discussion. And really, we have to go back to the 1970s when we looked at Public Law 94-142 when it started talking about free and appropriate education. Why did we even have that discussion then? It was really because of the fact that we looked at how we were educating children, and they were in institutions. We had some children, some of your families, that were not in a public school like they should have been. And people came together at that particular point. And even though the federal government lags behind, as Mr. Melcher clearly stated, and even the state, but at that point, it was more about human decency. Can we go any longer seeing individuals who are human beings being treated disproportionately out of character for what we know to be American values? So as a result, when you look at the chart that was presented by Mr. Melcher, it clearly shows back when in 2003, if we can fast forward to 2003, with the federal government still not living up to their commitment, still only doing at that point around about 12%, and it has even gone down to less now. You see the state in terms of its portions. Those particular pieces impact us. When we go to 2003, then we saw right at about 2008, you saw an increase, but the increases are not keeping up with the cost of inflation. So the reality of it is, if we say we're going to look and see all, serve all, and support all, we have to make this more of a human conversation versus an individual district. You heard the comments from Edina saying that they're running in trouble. The way that we have it right now from the formula, we're all going to run in trouble if we don't stop to address this issue as a whole across the country. This is not a Minnesota issue. I've been in 5 states. I can't keep a job, I guess. And everywhere I've gone, I've said, this is an issue. This is an issue. If we're going to say we're going to serve all, and in Robbinsdale Area School, we say academic excellence for all. Do we mean that? There's a serious impact if we continue with the current formula that's fundamentally flawed, that would not allow individual homeowners to realize the value of their home or the quality of life in their communities with this particular funding, because it forces us to choose a side, and we shouldn't be choosing which child can get served and which child will not get served based upon their zip code. So I pass out some sheets to you there, and I want to go over this next one because I think it's very important. We just went out for an operating levy because we're in a suburban metro area. We were able to go out for operating levy, and it passed. The highest passes percentage since 1995, passed with 62% approval rate of the community, because the community also recognized we want to have high-quality education. But the reality of it is, we went out for a operating levy that brings us in $6 million to fill a $14 million issue. Now, some of our colleagues are not as fortunate, or the community in which they live in do not have the resources to go back to the taxpayers and say, hey, this is not being funded at the state or the federal level like it should be, so we need you to ante up one more time. This is a problem. If we would have kept up with the cost of inflation, that would have been approximately, for our district, $620 more per student, or approximately $7.4 million. Over the last 2 years, we've had to cut a total of $17 million. There's no justice in injustice, and we have to think about it. It's not about pointing fingers. It's just coming to the table and saying, hey, how is this impacting the quality of life for everyone in our community, everyone in our country? And I think, personally, this is eating at our ability as a country to defend ourselves, because now economically and from a workforce standpoint, we're going to have less educated individuals, because we're pulling money from one set of children to educate appropriately. We should be educating special needs children, but we don't want to reduce the funding in general fund. But these are the decisions we're having to make. So the impact of eliminating state portion of the cross subsidy is very simple. It strengthens the community. In our general fund, we will be able to offer those high-quality programs that we want to do. We want to be able to start back pushing articulated skilled trades. We want to offer AP, IB, sports programming, the arts, all of those things. We're making a choice right now, and we're diminishing the quality in which every child in every community deserves by not doing that. We're also not addressing the needs of the social and emotional needs of our students. And right now, we're talking about mental health, but it also was in the 70s. That we looked and realized that students were having mental health issues, but we were not equipped in schools to identify them properly. Now that we've gotten better at identifying them, we don't have the resources to do it. So I ask you as a committee to please consider how we can increase the funding for special ed without reducing the funding for general ed. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Jenkins. Mr. Hanson.
Thank you. Chair Dabney and respective members of the House Education Committee, I would like to thank you for your time this morning. Just a little brief summation of my school district. My school district is roughly about an hour and 15, hour and a half straight west on 212 of the metro area. Buffalo Lake Hector Stewart has roughly about 496 students. Among these students, 21% or more receive some sort of special education services in one way or another. Very proud to state that in 15 and 16, BLHS was a reward school based on our test scores. Also, this last fall, we were a Blue Ribbon School Award, one of eight schools this last fall of 2018, as awarded by the Department of Education. As my two previous colleagues mentioned, there are various ways that special education dollars are spent. I can't go into great detail with what their budgets look like and where that comes from. I can tell you that a lot of the individuals that come and serve my students come via a co-op system, especially out of the Southwest Co-op out of Marshall, Minnesota, as well as Wilmer, Minnesota. Those costs, as Mr. Melcher dictated earlier in his presentation, definitely have not gone down. They definitely have increased. Just to give you an idea, just last year, fiscal year, a little over $1,300 more per special ed student than a regular ed student. If you look at the presentation that Mr. Melcher presented, that is very comparable to the Minneapolis and St. Paul schools. Again, my 496 students compared to those thousands of students. And again, it's not about who does it better or best. It's just on different ways of how we do that. And a little over $683,000 was spent. That's 11% of my budget. If we continue into fiscal year 19, we're approaching $750,000 in my little school district out there. What does special ed look like in my district? For one example, I have three students. We go pick them up at 6:30 in the morning from Shakopee due to a court order, and then we bring them to school. We make sure that they receive the services that we can give them here in our district, and then we give them a bus ride or van ride back to Shakopee. Another handful of students on another ride goes about 1 hour one way, and they receive specialized services in the area of mental health and that area. Those types of stories go on and on. As my colleagues up here will mention, and I know that all of us agree that every student deserves the best education that all of us can give them. I agree with what Dr. Jenkins was talking about. We definitely are robbing Peter to pay Paul. And that, is that right? Is that incorrect? How do you do that? You know, and obviously going through this budget system with the Minnesota school system, you can't do that in just half an hour. It takes a little bit. And I agree with what was said that, okay, are we going to offer these services, those types of things? As I near the end of my time, what are some solutions? Well, some of the solutions I do agree, definitely we need to find a long-term solution to what's going on here. Let's get away from that 2016 cap. We need to realize that these finances, et cetera, definitely have increased over the years in funding. And again, whether it's the state of Minnesota or the United States, it doesn't matter. We're not funding special education the way we were told that we were supposed to do it. What it winds up taking away in my district is computer tech education courses that we are required by the Department of Education to make sure that we offer and teach, as well as college and the high school classes, again, that we are required to teach. We wind up pulling back on that so that we can serve these students. And again, I wholeheartedly agree that we must make sure that we educate these students as best we can. Also, I would like to make sure, that, you know, just to reemphasize that the funding for these cooperatives, and I don't know how that looks here in the cities, but obviously when we have Marshall being an hour and 45 minutes away and Wilmer being another hour away, we need to make sure that this funding solution needs to be resolved, and it needs to be resolved very quickly. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Superintendent Funk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Once again, Mike Funk from Albert Lea Area Schools. Albert Lea Area Schools is a regional center. We are a pre-K-12 district of approximately 3,500 students. We have a general education budget in Albert Lea, which comes from state and our local levy, of about $35 million. We have a growing English language learner population, and we have an expanding special education population. Just for to give you a little perspective, from last year, we had 687 students on IEPs. This year, we have 750. Funding special education is a key issue in Albert Lea. Because of the shortfall in funding for special education, in 2018, we spent approximately $4.45 million from our $35 million in the general ed fund to cover the excess costs for special education. A couple of interesting statistics here. Our local voter operating levy is $1,245 per pupil. The cross subsidy from 2018 to pay for special education cost is $1,285 per pupil. So essentially, we are asking taxpayers to pay more to operate the district to pay off the cross subsidy that that we have in Albert Lea. If special education costs were fully funded, it's likely we would potentially wouldn't even need the operating levy. The other interesting statistic that I think it's important for folks to know is, as I said, we spent $4.45 million for excess special education costs. I believe for gifted and talented funding, we received $49,000 from the state of Minnesota last year. So when we're talking about educating all students equitably, there's a significant disconnect. And a lot of folks could say, well, maybe you could do an operating levy to do some of these extra things for your kids. Unfortunately, our operating levy is eaten up by the excess cost from the cross subsidy. So a couple points for the committee to consider. One, I'd like you to consider to increase the amount funded for special education to reduce that cross-subsidy impact. And two, another idea that I know has been floated out there for a number of years among school boards and school districts is consider granting school districts the authority to school boards the authority to renew existing operating levies without having to go for a referendum. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent. Representative Kunesh-Podein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, superintendents, for coming in on this very cold day. And I would like to thank my own personal superintendent, my boss. I am a Robbinsdale employee as well. Gratefully to receive a leave of absence so I can sit here and do what we can to make sure that this kind of atrocity gets cleaned up and cleared up. Because as a teacher in the middle school, and I'm a library media specialist, so I'm not a classroom teacher, but I do get to work with all of the teachers across the board, administration, students, and so I have a unique opportunity to understand the ramifications in a broad sense of the school itself. And when Dr. Jenkins, and he always does come back to that social-emotional aspect of how important it is that we are providing the services and the relationships that really make our students know that they are valued and that we are there to do the very best for them. And so I, again, would just like to thank you for coming in today. I look at your list of all the wants and needs, and I totally agree 150% of that. And I think my companion here, Chair Joachim, working in the special ed department, can understand that as well, and I support all of these issues that you bring up, and just know that we will work really hard to make sure that we're looking at this and doing the best that we can to make up that difference, because at the end of the day it really is all about the kids. So thank you,
Representative. Representative Bennett, you have a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to all four of you for coming, and I want to say a special thanks to Dr. Funk, same with Representative Kunesh-Podein. That's my school district, although I just retired not too long ago. I taught there for 33 years. I would like to, first of all, I want to say that I think this cross-subsidy issue is a huge issue. We need to deal with it. But I'd love to hear from Dr. Funk of Albert Lea Schools and also the other superintendents about the individual district growth cap, which I believe was put into effect by the 13-14 legislature and initiated maybe in 15. But how is that affecting, or will that affect, your school district?
Superintendent Funk.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bennett, we are scared that we are reaching the cap and will have significant financial impact upon our district, even more than the cross-subsidy currently does. We have not reached it yet, though, in Albert Lea.
In Robbinsdale, what wasn't foreseen at the time, we conveyed fair downtown to Robbinsdale, so we have two hit it, and there were a significant number of students that we're impacted by right now.
Any of the other Superintendent Gothard?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bennett, St. Paul Public Schools is at the cap as well and has huge ramifications as our numbers continue to total with the services we provide.
Superintendent Hanson?
I would have to agree with Dr. Jenkins and Dr. Gothard. Even though we're only 496 students, we have met that cap already. And that's, again, that's amazing compared to the number of students. I agree. We're going to start losing teachers. We're going to start losing services. We're going to start losing classes, programming. That once we start losing that, we're going to be able to offer the three R's, if that's what you want to call it. I'm dating myself here a little bit. But we're going to be able to offer the three R's, and that's it. And I don't think any school district, as well as the members of the committee here, wish to get to that level ever.
Thank you. Superintendent Jenkins?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the impact, before we even start our budgeting process, there's $15.5 million we're going to have to transfer to make sure that we're meeting the needs of all of our students and special needs. And let me please say, please do not take this to take anything away from our special needs children. They should be funded at the highest levels, in particular the needs that we have right now from social-emotional to mental health just throughout the country. We need to continue on that path, but we just need to find a fair way to make sure that the other children who are not receiving services are receiving the highest level quality as well.
Well, Superintendent, I often remind people as we have this conversation that the underfunding of special education costs the special education students as well as their peers, because the majority of special education students spend the majority of their days in the traditional classroom. And so when that classroom gets larger, the number of students get larger because you don't have the funds to keep a handle on class sizes, the special education student is in that classroom. And when you are having to trim other programs, extracurricular opportunities, transportation, everybody gets shorted in that process.
Thank you. It affects all the students.
Yeah. With that, gentlemen, thank you all for your time today. Superintendent Hansen, it was always difficult as a teacher in the Buffalo Hanover Montrose schools on mornings like this when they'd announce the school closings and you'd be listening alphabetically and WCCO would say, and school closings include Buffalo, and you'd go, yes, and they go, Lake Hector. And it's like, ah! Superintendent.
Chair Dabney, you got a little bit of retribution today. Buffalo Hanover is closed today. We're 2 hours late.
So
you're welcome.
Thank you very much. Members, we have our first bill for the session up. Representative O'Neill has House File 207, am I right? It was referred to the Education Finance Division by the Ways and Means Committee. Please come forward and take your seat. Representative DeMuth, would you like to move House File 207 to be before the committee and laid over for possible inclusion in the Education Finance Omnibus
Bill? Yes, I will make that motion.
Thank you very much. Representative O'Neill, welcome to the committee. We do not have any amendments.
That's correct.
On your bill, very good. Just a reminder to the committee that we do have a 24-hour rule in place in the committee. With that, Representative O'Neill, if you'd please share your bill with us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And some members may remember this bill from last session. So this bill passed the House, it passed the Senate, it was in the omnibus bill, and unfortunately, as the governor vetoed that, he vetoed something really critical for my district. And this is something that is incredibly unique. You just heard a long presentation about cross-subsidy. This is not that. This is not a cross-subsidy issue. This is not a special ed per se funding issue. This is unique to the school district of Monticello. And I'm going to let them explain that, but just very briefly, what this does is there was a change both federally and state that interplayed that forced them to change the structure of their co-op. They had been a fiscal host, and they had to dissolve that, and they had to rebuild to a different structure. And as they rebuilt, and they had to rebuild the funding formula, some things got lost off of the funding formula. For example, you know how incredibly complicated the education funding formula is. Well, this is even more complicated than what you even know, because there was a back-end multiplier specific to the school district of Monticello that had been there since probably the mid-90s, I think. In any case, all of these changes and all of these miscommunications between the school district and MDE created a $1.6 million funding hole. So what this does is this makes them whole from the $1.6 million hole and forgives the clawback of $800,000 in 19, and it gives them $200,000 in the 4 years that go after that. So this is incredibly unique. There is no other school district that has come across this issue. It was an error by MDE, and unfortunately we don't have George Holt here that was there at the time going through all of this with them. And he's since retired and left the department, but he was unavailable. He was here, if you remember, last session to explain the complex situation that this school district has been through. But in short, this is making them whole from a mistake that was made in calculations, including a back-end multiplier that was left off, to try to make them whole so that they They also have cross-subsidy issues, just like every other school. They have other issues, but this is just insurmountable. This is something that they will tell you the incredible impact of $1.6 million immediate hole on a very small school district. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers, and they can explain more of what happened and how they have been trying to mitigate this. I'm going to call it a disaster because I don't know how else to characterize this in this poor little school district. So thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Ms. Burkholder, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tina Burkholder. I'm the Director of Business Services at Monticello Public Schools, and I have been there since August of 2012. I just want to thank you for giving us the time today to tell you a little bit about Monticello's story, to help you understand the unique challenges Monticello experienced during a major change in the state special education formula. In the 1970s, a special education cooperative was formed at Monticello. The cooperative was created with surrounding school districts to collaborate and share special ed services. Monticello was the host of the cooperative, and other districts that were part of the collaboration included Becker, Big Lake, Elk River, and St. Michael. Later on, as Elk River grew, they withdrew and left the co-op. In 2006, the Monticello School District was contacted by MDE to change the host configuration. The host configuration was not in statute, and the only way a cooperative could officially be recognized by the state was to form a joint powers. At the time, the Monticello School District made the case that it was more cost-effective to stay the way we were. If the Monticello School District was no longer the host and the special ed cooperative was a separate entity, more costs would occur, such as a separate finance system, a separate student system, separate insurance coverages, etc. With the argument of collaboration and shared services, MDE let things be. But in 2014, the state came back and notified the Monticello School District that we had to switch from a host configuration to a separate joint powers arrangement with the special ed cooperative, or we'd be forced to receive federal funds individually instead of as one cooperative. After doing the analysis, the reallocation of federal funds outweighed the extra costs of separating. The new joint powers arrangement had to start beginning with the 15-16 school year, the same time a new state special education aid formula was being implemented. But assurances were made that we would be held harmless in the change. With the change directive, we did what responsible leaders would do. The Monticello School District and members of the cooperative worked with representatives from MDE to understand the formula, how it impact member districts, and plan accordingly from about 2014 to 2016. One example of our proactive planning is that we removed a number of the students from the Monticello student count and transferred that over to the special ed cooperative so that the cooperative could generate aid and receive cash right away in July of 2015 so they could pay their bills. And so that same number of students were reduced from the Monticello so that we wouldn't generate too much cash or aid during that year where we'd have to pay it back. During the 15-16 school year, special ed entitlement reports were being generated by MDE to give school district estimates on their aid for the 15-16 school year. The reports generated estimates that were similar to what the Monticello district received the previous 2 years. In October of 2016, Monticello noticed a significant change in the latest MDE report regarding our special ed revenue and questioned it right away. We met with MDE and told not to worry and wait until January of 2017. When the new reports came out in January, the revenue estimate did not improve and, in fact, was worse. In February 2017, we were notified by MDE that there had been issues with the formula and there was nothing they could do to help us. We requested a meeting with Commissioner Castilius and Dr. Melcher to better understand the change. In the end, the final special education report had $800,000 less in revenue than what Monticello was expecting and would have to pay it back by June of 2016. In April and May of 2017, Monticello worked hard to receive support from the legislation to delay the repayment to allow more time to adjust to the new reality of receiving $800,000 less in special ed each year. In looking at our timeline, hopefully it gives you an understanding how budgeting for special ed is difficult for districts, and I believe Dr. Melcher mentioned that as well, how complicated this formula is. School districts have to estimate prior to July 1st of each year and adopt a budget on a very complicated formula, and final revenues aren't determined until almost 18 months after the fact. The Monticello School Board adopted 2 years of budget before the final estimate for 2015 was finalized or had any indication that something would be different. And that kind of goes back to the 1.6, how that number came to be. It's receiving 800,000 less over two years. Had better information been known, our school board would have made different decisions in 2015 on a bond referendum and an operating referendum based on what was previously received and estimated by MDE. Had better estimates been known, different questions would have been asked of our community. A lower bond referendum and a higher operating referendum question would have been proposed. The Monticello community is very conservative, and the school board was extremely thoughtful on the two questions proposed to the community in 2015 to minimize the tax impact to our residents and businesses. Because of the trust the community had with the district, the two questions passed with a 70% approval rating, the highest in its history. As one of the district leaders during this transition time, I believe that we did everything that a reasonable person could have done. We worked with MDE to ensure we had a full understanding of the structure change and the formula change. We used that information to guide our school board on financial forecasts and planning. It has been upsetting, to say the least, to stand in front of your board and your staff and make budget recommendations to significantly reduce staff and programming for students when you've done your homework. The Monticello School District understands we need to follow the same formula as the other school districts. The proposed language would help Monticello School District transition to the new formula change, the joint powers change, and time to adapt to our new reality. And like Representative O'Neill mentioned, it did pass last time, and hopefully we'll get it through both the House and Senate again to be in the final bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Burkholder. Mr. Kraft, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, my name is Mr. Gary Kraft. I thank you, Mr. Chair, and the members. I have been working with the Monticello School District for 34 years. I've been a custodian there, and 12 of those years I've been a head custodian. So as my coworkers say, I've been around a while. So, and I plan on being with the Monticello School District for many more years. Monticello is home to me. I was raised there. I went to kindergarten at Pinewood Elementary School, and currently that's where I'm the head custodian at. Kind of ironic, but it's cool. With seeing the funding issues that is going on with Monticello, I'd like to kind of give you just an overview of, from a custodian perspective, of what we see daily in our schools and how this special education funding is has been affecting all of us at Monticello. So I come to you today to discuss this issue brought to you before by our colleagues. To start off, I'd like to tell you how, as custodians, we see the budget issues affect all of us in our schools. Some people might think, as a custodian, all we do is clean the schools. As most of you know, it's much more than that. We are very involved in our buildings. We are very involved in our public relations with the community. We take care of many things at the schools. We manage the heat and cooling in our buildings. We plow the parking lots, shovel the sidewalks, put down ice melt so everyone is safe when they arrive in the morning. Also take care of the grounds, setting up for events, and along with this, all of our regular everyday issues and daily tasks that we have to take care of. Taking care of the grounds is quite hard in Monticello. We've got a lot of buildings with a lot of grounds to cover. So as custodians, we are very dedicated to make sure that these buildings are taken care of properly, and everything is set for our students, our staff, and the community when they visit Monticello. One of the things I want to talk to you about is when we do this, and Monticello has been going through cuts, from a custodial perspective, we see every morning the teachers that are so excited to come into the classroom every day to work hard at what they do, and then the excitement on the students' faces when they're in the hallways. The custodians always have a great relationship, as with the rest of the staff, with our students. But when times are tough and there are cuts to be made, it is very difficult to see some of our teachers walk down the hallways trailing with 30 plus students, but yet they still have a smile on their face. They do what they have to do. They try as hard as they do, as the rest of us do every day. We all know that cuts are never easy. Each year, there's always more to be done. Everyone must do more with less. and we do that at Monticello as best we can. Our motto at Monticello is every kid, every day. So with this crisis that Monticello is dealing with about our special education funding, it has been getting harder and harder to provide what is needed for our students and staff on a daily basis. For example, with more responsibilities added to us, we've had to change from what was our daily maintenance schedules to trying to do the best we can to just keep things running in our facilities, hoping that nothing breaks, knowing that things are being missed and there just isn't enough time in the day to get them all done. This is very frustrating for all of us. I know this is something that we have to do, unfortunately, but the times call for this. We do the best we can. But I also know the costs of major repairs are much higher to the district down the road without regular maintenance. But with budget restraints, this is what we have to do for now. With the dedicated crew that I have, I see that they are truly trying to get things done, but at what cost? I now worry about them trying to get all the extra things asked of us each and every day by going just a little bit faster. They want to take care of their staff. That is usually when injuries occur, when they are going harder and faster to try and get more done with less time. As their head custodian, I truly worry about that. I worry about their well-being. I do not want to see one of my guys get injured on the job. But I totally get where they're coming from with trying to get things done. I am proud of them for that. This is also very hard on morale, knowing that one thing that you may have missed and not had time to do that morning may be pointed out to you by a staff member or a visiting parent that something wasn't done very well. It is hard on the custodial staff because we do truly take pride in our buildings and grounds. They come into the work, we have sub-custodians that come in to work for us, and when we have custodians that are absent, we try hard to make sure that everything is still covered in our buildings for the teachers and the staff. Some of the examples are when a custodian is gone, we try and do what we can. With the budget cuts and losing some staff, it may mean the result of some entryways not being cleaned as well as they should be, or a hallway may not get swept, or trash may get missed. These are just some of the examples of the things that are happening in our buildings due to cuts. I see every day when the teachers are coming into the buildings ready for another day's work, trying their best, walking down the hallways with 30-plus kids, like I said, I stop and I wonder, how do they do it? We greet them in the mornings as they arrive with a good morning and a have a good night at the end of the day when the teachers leave to go home, all knowing how much they have to take home with them every night, and their job is nowhere near done just because they're going home. This, while all of our support staff throughout the buildings that work with the students are doing their absolute best with what they have. How are we to keep our heads up and continue this way? I truly don't know. But in Monticello, we do, because that's who we are. Due to these funding issues we are dealing with at Monticello, this is why I volunteered to come here and speak with you today. For if nothing is done, the future means more cuts, less staff, less resources, and most of all, less one-on-one time with our valuable students. We are asking for your help, because if we can't correct this issue with special education funding, all services at Monticello will become more strained and all of our kids will be affected. No one here wants that. I am proud to call myself one of the staff members of the Monticello School District, as well as the rest of my staff. We all would like to send an invitation to everyone here in this room. If you have the time, please come to Monticello Schools. Visit any one of our schools, and you will truly see what Monticello means when we say every kid, every day. So we ask for your help on this, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Kraft. This is a public hearing. The committee would now like to hear from anyone in the public who wishes to testify either for or against House File 207. All right. Mr. Heller, does your testimony have to do specifically with House File 207? and the change in fiscal arrangements for the Monticello School District with the changes in the special education formula.
Yes.
Mr. Heller, please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Rick Keller. I'm officially represent the twice exceptional people with print disabilities. On House File 207, I support it. One thing I don't, as school districts have to weigh it to get bills passed here, and there's interest occurred in a, this is a financial committee, right? I don't know how that plays a role in this piece. If the State Department of Education would have applied more illustrations based on the principle of universal design, because today I heard the word understanding many times, and in 2015, the teachers were saying the same thing, and the legislature asked them to set the special education levels, but I don't believe they use universal design. Since it's complex, State Department could make this easier for people to understand. This is a learning moment for everybody. It's not just that we're being sympathetic with the process here, but I heard that they did not really get how this impacted them, and I don't even know if a memo went out to other school districts, but unless we do illustrations now, based on principle of universal design, if it is complex, and if there's a chart that it can help people walk through it to understand what might be triggered if you do this, every action has a reaction. The legislature could pass some legislation, give some money to the State Department to apply universal design to complex things so this does not happen again. That's all I have to say. Thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. Is there anyone else from the public wishing to testify regarding House File 207? Seeing none, that closes the public portion of this hearing. Representative Sandstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, Mr. Kraft, I just wanted to say a big shout-out to you and thank you for the work that you do and to all other custodians. You keep our buildings running, so thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative O'Neill, any closing statement?
So I would just ask that the committee would again consider this bill this year. It's a huge hole that was left behind through no mistake of the school district themselves. It was a very complicated, very messy funding formula change. And it, when we dug into it, it was unbelievable to see that even somewhere back in the funding formula, a hard-coded back-end multiplier was a part of this entire process. I have never heard of half of these things that have happened to this poor school district all at once. And the last thing I would say, if you would consider a new ruling by the Department of Revenue has just come down for the city of Monticello and for the county as a whole, and it has to do with property tax with this with Xcel Energy. So on top of this $1.6 million hole that they have, they also will be dealing with other issues because Xcel Energy prevailed, and so they'll be receiving back some of that property tax. So it's the perfect storm on top of the perfect storm on top of the perfect storm for this poor little community. So I just ask you to please make them whole in this one situation, and it would go a long way. They've endured, and they've made cuts, and they've done everything that they possibly can do. And we're just asking for some grace. Right now, it is a repayment that we're asking to be forgiven, and then going forward, it would continue to make them whole and make this transition a little bit easier. And I can tell you that they have done their part and they have tried, but they are at their wits' end at this point. So please have some grace for them. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. With that, Representative Danith renews her motion that House File 207 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Education Finance Omnibus Bill. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, stay warm, and I guess by Sunday, stay dry. Thank you for coming down and testifying today.